How's everybody doing? Doug, you sounded a little bit weak last week. Was it just me, or you sounded maybe a little under the weather or something?
I was really under the weather last week. I had a kind of a hard-hitting, cold, flu-ish thing.
Yeah, you sound fine today. Good.
Yeah, I got cut past it, so.
Hey, Rivka, how's your cold? Oh, I thought I heard her.
No, you heard. This is Caroline.
Hello, Caroline. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you.
Who else do we have on?
I'm here.
Who's that? Jim?
Jim, yes. I'm sorry.
All right. How you doing?
Good.
Jim, are you better?
Yeah, I'm mostly better.
Good.
We got something contagious going on the phone. That's interesting. So we got Mike that just joined us, and Ryan. It looks like Ryan is in Wisconsin. And Mike, how you doing? Hope you guys are doing well. Okay, Ryan, thanks for the audio confirmation. What time do you have? Do we have 11:15 already? Should we wait another minute or so?
Mine says 16.
Is Cal with us?
Yeah, she's...
I'm here.
Hey, Cal, good morning.
Good morning.
And Josh, I guess, has been busy with the kids, so he hasn't been on with us for a while. Hopefully he's getting the recordings.
Have you talked with him lately? You know how he's doing?
Rev Man actually sent me a picture of him in the shul with his daughter.
Oh, wonderful.
What's her name? The older one, the blonde.
Yeah, name is escaping me.
Yeah, me too. She's cute.
So
I went over to Josh's new house when I was in Arizona in June. So we hung out for about an hour. She was really just, you know, full of life and questions and answers. Regular kid.
Did you say Josh's new house?
Yeah, he moved to Phoenix. So he had a...
Oh, okay, the house in Phoenix, right. Okay. I just wasn't sure if he'd moved again.
Oh. Yeah, Ryan, Mike, doing okay. Thanks for asking. Okay, so why don't we get going? Yeah, I'm going to try and email Josh later. All right. Okay, so we finished up the... We talked last week about how King Solomon was giving certain principles. He was laying them down that should lead a person to not abandon the life of the Torah and not follow his arrogance and his emotions. He gave principles. And then in verse 9, chapter 8, verse 9, he talked about how the practical comes into play. So he didn't want to just give principles, but he wanted to also bring, practical information in response to that. That's why he said that I saw something. And again, we underlined, it was your point, Doug, that we underscored the point that he's talking about what he saw happening under the sun. And that's why in 10, where he said that... there are wicked people that live long lives, and they have, not long lives, but they have a decent life, and they're buried, and their sons come and fill the place. And in contrast, you have very sacred people, sanctified people, that they leave the earth with no children, and they're forgotten in the city that they were. So that seems to be a question that people have in terms of justice. But like you said, Doug, that's really a foolish statement, because why should that be of any value to the person once he's dead? It's not of value to the person that once he's dead, he had a good burial, and that his sons are filling his place. That doesn't do anything for him. A person's soul is based purely on his actions. And once he's dead, that's it. His soul is, you know, is it's sealed. His perfection, whatever he did in life. That's why the rabbis were upset at death, not because they had any fear of death, but they realized that they're older. They could not do any good actions anymore. That was the end of their ability to perfect themselves. Okay, but we said that this is hell. This is futile. Not that it's futile to follow. That's what it looks like on the surface. It's like a person just reads this on the surface. He thinks that King Solomon is saying it's a futile thing to follow the Torah because the wicked end up with a great burial and their children that follow their ways, and the righteous people sometimes have no children and their memory is forgotten. So therefore, what? Is he saying that it's futile then to follow the Torah? No. He's saying that the very statement is futile. Okay. It's a futile type of a critique. Because, like we said, it does not matter that the sons of the wicked guy take his place and continue his legacy, and it doesn't matter in another case that somebody didn't leave over children. The real assessment of the person is the person, not subsequent events on earth after he's departed. Then we started the new verse, so we'll move to new ground now. We did read it, but let's now go into it. So verse 11, all right, so we're moving ahead now. 8:11. And he says, on account, or that, which of course can't be the beginning of the thought. You can't start off a statement and just say, on account, or that. It has to be connected with the previous. So let's see what he says. On account that the matter is not done, the matter of evil is not done quickly. Therefore, the hearts of men are filled to do evil. Okay, since the, and according to Ibn Ezra, the straight explanation is, it's pretty close to the verse. He says as follows, since there is no revenge taken and payment and recompense paid back by God for the evil ways of the wicked, since it's not done quickly, therefore, the children of men fill their hearts and their souls to have the desire to do evil because fear is removed from them. Okay, and yeah, hi Abner, and welcome online. Good to see you too. Good month to you too. Okay. So what is he saying now? And he continues in 12, again with the word on account. A further explanation. On account that the sinner will do evil hundreds of times, and his existence will endure. But King Solomon says, but I know that there will be good to those who fear God, those who fear from before him. And in 13, which is the last of the series of verses, and there will not be good, in fact, to the evil people. And they will not have long days. They'll be like a shadow, a fleeting shadow, that they do not fear before God, the judge. Okay, so you have the series of verses, 11, 12, and 13.
Rabbi, could you read your translation of 12 again?
Okay. Please. It's just me. I'm not using a translation, so I'll just do the... I'll read it how I'm understanding it. That a sinner will do evil hundreds of times, and he will endure, or he will have a length of days. For I also know that there will be good to those who fear God, to those who fear from before him.
There's a really interesting redundancy, or so it appears, at the end of that verse.
Yeah, I saw. The fear before God, and they fear before him. Well, actually, no. It really is not redundancy, because he's saying that, for I know, in contrast, he says, I know, on the one hand, the beginning of verse 12 is saying that a sinner will sin many, many times, and he'll have a long life. But in contrast, I know that there will be good to those who fear God. I mean, that's the reference. That's the appellation. Who is this person? He's a person who fears God. But what does he do in action? That he fears from before him. So he's defining who is the one who fears God, who fears God. So he knows that he's standing before him, meaning the person has his fear is that God is real. He's in the Hebrew, the sense of the word of Asheyiru Milfanov, you could say it means that he's afraid to do any sins before God. He's recognizing that he is standing and everything is being accounted for.
The Judaica Press translation, and I just want to see if these are saying the same thing, in the second half of the verse says, but I know too that it will be good for those who fear God because they fear him.
That doesn't sound right. He has to be adding something. Because, if he's saying because, he has to add something new. So when he says, but I know that there will be good to those who fear God, but now what is the fear? What is the expression of that fear? That they hold back from sinning. Not just that they have a fear, and it's not expressed in any way, like a crippling type of a fear. He's explaining further. What is that fear? They fear from before him, meaning when from before him, of course. No, they fear from, you have to fill in the space over there. Their fear is expressed from sinning before him. As opposed to those who, they sin, and they sin so many times, and they have long lives. Is it clearer the way I'm saying it, or no?
I think so.
Read the Judaica, read your translation one more time.
But I know, too, that it will be good for those who fear God because they fear him.
It needs more. Meaning he knows that there will be good for those who, to the fearers of God is really the right way to say it. I mean, that's their reference. Like the person, like the wealthy, that's the reference to that person. It's not telling you how he becomes wealthy. It's just telling you that's his title. So he's saying, who's the title of the people that will have the good? The fearers of God. God-fearers. But how do they express their fear? Asher yiru milfanav, that they are afraid from sinning before him. So it has to be, you have to add that in there. Otherwise it's redundant, you're right.
Wouldn't that refer then to not fear like, I'm standing before the king and he'll get mad at me, but a fear of the consequences of my actions in this world, because the verse doesn't allude or doesn't seem to mention the world to come.
So, well, I wouldn't say that, because you see the beginning of this very verse says that those who sin have very long lives. So it should be a fear of the ultimate, of the soul, what's going to happen to the soul after the person departs.
Yeah, but, okay, I admit to being troubled by the point for two reasons. One is that Proverbs, at least the way that I have learned it, is very practical in terms of life today. Granted, it prepares you for the world to come, but that fearing God is equated to fearing the consequences of one's actions in a practical way. And the other is that the Torah mentions almost nothing about the world to come. So is King Solomon alluding to all that of, okay, the sinner has it good here, but boy, when you get on the other side, it's bad news? Or is there something there that he's trying to tell us about this life?
Well, it's both. He is alluding to the next as well, because he's saying that, see, what's the point over here? He says in Yud 11, he says that what is the cause, what's contributing to those who have that, you know, the question in 11? The question 11 is that on the one hand you see these people that are sinning, they have nice burials, and the children take their place and continue the legacy. And the other hand, you have the righteous people that don't have kids, they have no legacy, and they are forgotten. So you could, a person who's foolish will say that's a question of justice. But he says no. He says that that's foolish because, number one, like you said, that really doesn't affect the person. The fact that he leaves over people in this world. He's gone from this world, so there's no effect. But in 11, he says, excuse me, that was verse 10. In 11, he says, what's the cause for this? Why do people live sinfully? Because they aren't paid back quickly for the evil that they do. And that, like Ibn Ezra says, so therefore fear is removed from them. And that means it's not until the next world that they are going to pay for it. Because we know there's justice. We know that the Torah tells us all about the punishments and about the excision of the soul. And the reality of the soul's existence afterwards is something which we admit. Just because it's not taking up a lot of quote-unquote real estate in the Torah, it doesn't mean that it's not true. So it has to be part of the equation, and certainly here is part of the equation. Because you see here, where's the justice? You know, and you take a look at the Sadia Gaon in his book, the Book of Beliefs and Opinions, where he talks about how everything is equaled out in the next world. But the thing over here I want to draw your attention to is that he says that it's not done quickly. Right, we touched on it last week. So that gives a conviction to the person, the fear is gone. That happened also by Agag, who was the king of the Amalekites. And he thought that since Saul didn't follow the decree of Samuel to kill him, and he left Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive, as well as the sheep and the oxen. So he thought to himself, and the verse is recorded, he says, certainly, the pangs of death have passed, meaning I'm going to be saved now. But 2 seconds later, Samuel followed God's will and slew him, chopped him up. But you see, I'm bringing it up because you see how a person will tend to make a assessment. What's happening right now is going to continue. So since Agag didn't see himself being killed immediately, he thought, for sure, I'm safe. And over here as well, since a person is not punished immediately, therefore his convictions about his whole value system are wrong. And look what the verse says. Since he's not paid back for his sins quickly, therefore his heart is full of doing evil. What is he adding that in there for? It seems that the person is looking for the justification to live a lustful, sinful life. He can't do it, though, until he's got some sort of a basis. And what's his basis? The guy sins. He sees a case where a guy sins and nothing's happening to him. He ate some ham and cheese and there's no lightning bolts. And I've heard that numerous times where people see that, there's really nothing happening, and so that's their conviction. And therefore, once they've got some basis, now those emotions to sin, which just satisfy the urges that they've been holding back, now can be completely be released, and now they're completely involved in sin. That's why they're filled, he says. Their hearts are filled with it, because that's what they've desired the whole time. They just couldn't do it because they had fear. But once they have a case where they see somebody who sins and nothing happens to them, That's the justification. Right, so it gives us some insight. And also Ibn Ezra, by the fact that he says that the fear is removed from them, so it shows you how they're functioning. It's they're looking to satisfy their urges, but there's a fear that something's going to happen. They're not functioning out of what is good for me in life. They've already got their agenda set. They want the lusts. They want the urges. They want to follow whatever pleasures they can satisfy themselves with. But the only thing holding them back is fear. Once they have a justification, so then they can go full throttle. Okay.
Rabbi, that makes me think of Adam and Eve in the beginning, when Eve, she didn't get the punishment right away, and so she thought, well, maybe there isn't anything to this, and so she was encouraged to eat the fruit of the tree.
Yeah, that's good. That's a good case.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing, Carol. Yeah, good morning. Rabbi, can I just make mention of something that I was thinking about?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, please. When the redundancy that Doug was talking about, sometimes I wonder, when things are told to us twice, it's like when a parent is trying to tell a child, he says it one way, then he says it another way, to make sure the child heard it, like a reprimand. And I'm just wondering if that doesn't have this, if that wasn't meant the same way here. No?
Again?
When a parent is reprimanding a child, he'll say to the child, don't do it, something, don't do something, and then he'll tell him, don't make me tell you again, don't do this thing. And like he'll repeat himself, maybe in a different way, to make sure it got into the brain. There's redundancy, it's a repetition.
That's
the same thing being said twice. But Doug was asking, I'm wondering if that may be part of it.
Well, what you're saying is true. That does help, but I think we resolved it. We said it's not redundant. We said that when he says that the end of verse 12, that he says, but I know that there will be good for the fearers of God. And then he says afterwards, those who fear from before him, it's not redundancy. It's explaining what the fearers of God do in action.
Okay.
They're not fearers of God just in terms of being mentally crippled and they just can't move, but the fears of God, the fact they hold themselves back from satisfying their urges, they don't sin. So it's a new point. It's not redundant.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Okay, let me see. Afner has a question on screen. He's saying, why does it not happen? What is then the value of being a tzaddik if there are no guarantees of some reward here too? Well, the rabbi said that there's no reward for Torah in this world. It is true that a person who lives intelligently is going to comply with how the world operates, so he'll have a better life just practically because he's using intelligence, he's following how the world works and how providence works, and on the whole he will have a good life. He'll have a better life. He'll have the enjoyment of wisdom, which the wicked person doesn't have. He's constantly the verse. It says that the wicked are like a raging ocean, like they're as turbulent as the waves, meaning they're going up and down in their emotions. And it's not really a steady, comfortable life. They're constantly being emotionally agitated. So it's not a pleasurable life. Whereas a person is wise, he has a very stable and steady life, and his energies can always be focused into what gives the person the greatest enjoyment. So he is having the best life here. Now, your question is really, why is it then that there'll be some, what's the value of being a tzaddik? Well, he's not saying here that the righteous person, that we call a tzaddik, he's not saying here that the tzaddik has any loss at this point. Right now, he's explaining the phenomena of what causes one to sin. And he's saying that there's a phenomenon, and you'll see how he continues this theme if you're sensitive to the words in the verses. He says that in 11, that since the punishment is not given to the wicked quickly, so therefore it convinces them to fear. That's it. And but you should know that what it's telling you is that what we spoke about before, a very important but subtle point, and that is that a foolish or wicked person assesses value based on what he sees here and now, the immediate, a myopic view, a very small view of what's just happening now. He doesn't look at the grand scale or the span of time that's very long to make his assessments. He should. He should do that. The rabbis tell us in Pirkei Avos that the wise man is one who knows the result of his actions. Those results can be 10 years down the line. So, but the wicked person is very impulsive, and he's looking for instant gratification. So he assesses things as well, but his assessment is quickly because he wants to satisfy himself quickly. So the first thing he's telling us is that this type of infantile, instantaneous, impulsive personality is going to make a quick assessment. I'm not getting paid back now. So the fear of punishment is not completely lost, but that's foolish. Look, if you just study the history and you see the cases where God punished people, you can't ignore the facts. The flood, all the cases where God punished individuals, societies, all right? That's number one. Number two, in 12, he goes on and he says that you'll have a sinner who sins 100 times, and then he endures. Another aspect that convinces the person. That's why he continues. He says that on account of two things. On account of 11, that punishment doesn't come quickly. So the person doesn't see any pain associated with his evil right now. So therefore, he makes a foolish assessment. And he says further that you see sinners that they can sin not just one time and that they're not paid right away, but they sin many times. That's the new point. Okay? So the new point in 12 is that the person will do the sin many times, 100 times, and nothing happens. So he's not saying that the tzaddik is having anything bad yet. We didn't get to that. Okay? So let's wait until we get to that. We'll look at the verses after. Now, but he says as well, on Ibn Ezra, take Ibn Ezra in 12, he says that a person that will sin 100 times, because you will see a sinner, one sinner that does evil 100 times, and his life goes on fine for a long time. Even though the intelligent people who understand matters, and also I know this, King Solomon says, that there will be good to those who fear God, even if it doesn't happen fast. Meaning he's now showing you the flip side, that on the one hand, you'll see evil will be happening, and the person has a long life. He commits his evil hundreds of times, and he keeps on going on. But this is also, there's another point you should keep aware of, be aware of, and that is that a person will do good. And this is at the end of 12, where he says, this also I know, that there will be good to those who fear God. You see, now again, will be in the future. We don't have to assess it right now. We don't have to make an assessment right now that the good hasn't come to the righteous yet. And this is now after your point. So, you have three words in these two verses that tell you the theme that's going on. Number one, it says in 11 that why do people sin? Because their punishment doesn't come quickly. Number two, you see it says in 12 that the person will sin 100 times. So again, he's taking a snapshot. Look, I'm doing this 100 times. Nothing bad is happening to me. So I'm going to assess this as being as a great way to live. And number three, there's a protracted payment back to the righteous. The King Solomon says, but I know that there will be good. There will be. So you see how he's trying to tell you he's addressing this problem with these two verses. Not only that, he says in 13, he says not only that, but the good will not even happen to them. In certain cases, you'll see the wicked where good does not happen to them, and they don't have a long life. So don't tell me that this is an absolute rule. You see some people that are wicked having, they go and it seems to be they sin one time and there's no punishment happening really quickly to them. Or you see the sinner sinning 100 times and nothing happens to him. King Solomon warns you, don't make a rule, because there is not going to be good to certain wicked people. So now a rule means something which happens all the time. That's what a rule is. The King Solomon shows, you know, you have certain cases where they don't have long lives, the wicked. And they're just like a shade, right? Just like they're in a shadow. That's what he says in 13. And they don't fear from before God. Okay. So you see the theme. Let me just stop here and see if there's any comments or questions.
So we're really talking about then consequences.
We're talking about, that really fits under a bigger umbrella. How do we assess what is of value? How do we assess value? Is it something which is made instantaneously, or is it made by a small worldview, a myopic view? Is it the fact that I see a person sin once, nothing happens to him, I just take one case and I make a rule based on that? Is that how scientists, you know, develop principles? They have an experiment, happens once, and that's it? Okay, now we have a new law that we found? Or do they test it over and over again to make sure it's repeated without break? Of course, it's the latter. Scientists don't say they found a new theory or rule unless they have something which is replicated. All the similar circumstances and the exact same results take place. But if he says that one way a person makes an error and he has the wrong assessment of value is because he only looks at one case. Another time, that's verse 11. He sees a person sin and there's no punishment. So the foolish thing that he did is that he now makes a rule from that. Okay, that means that I can sin and there's no such thing as punishment. So that's foolish, of course. And in verse 12, what he adds on is that not only does a person make a foolish assessment based on a singular event, but even if he sees the event happen many times, and he sees, for example, the sinner will sin 100 times, and he has a long life, but now it's still a singular event because it's one person that he's looking at that this is happening to. So that could still be a singular assessment. So again, the principle is don't take one case. And that's why in 13, King Solomon comes back and shows you, no, I'll show you another case which is contrary to your findings. So now you cannot make your principle. You can't. It's very scientific. This is sticking to the rules of science. But primarily it's that there's the emotion, there's the impulsive nature in man, and there's a tendency to want to judge things and to, I have to know now. You've heard people say that before. They need to make a quick judgment on something. And that comes from an insecurity. So you can always go back a step. Now, where is this coming from? For example, when we said that the person will now not have the fear of recompense because he sees one person, he does evil, nothing happens, so now his fear of punishment is gone because there's one case. So the fear of punishment is gone, but that's because he's looking at this one case, a very small view. But why is he looking at a very small view? Why is he rushing to make the judgment? Because he's insecure. He needs to know, what is it? Is this thing good or bad? But the wise person, he's not impulsive. He understands that sometimes you have to wait to come away with a conclusion. That's what I would say is going on here. The real one major point is King Solomon is exposing the difference between the wise person and the foolish person. It's that impulsive nature, or the need, or that insecure nature, where they're trying to assess what is of value or not. How do I estimate something as being good or bad? So you can't take a singular event. and make a rule. That's that you can't do. That's foolish. But it's also interesting too how he shows you that the singular event could even be, or the singular case, I should say, could even be, if you see one person, he sins 100 times, nothing happens to him. That's also still a singular event. It's not worthy of you assessing it based on one person. Who cares that one person has this a million times, and he sins a million times and nothing happens to him? King Solomon shows you here, there's wicked people that sin and they do die quickly, and they're just like a fleeting shade. There's nothing to them. Their days are not lengthened, he says. Lo ya'aruch yamim. Just like a shade comes and goes very quickly, the sun comes in and out of the cloud. So also you have cases like that. So he dispels the notion, the assumption, that the person makes in verses 11 and 12. But you see, the person is making this because the person wants to rush to have the satisfaction of the desires. And that's why we explained it very well in 11, that he says that once they see that the punishment doesn't come immediately, it's not fast, it's not an immediate punishment. I see a person who commits evil, and nothing happens. So now, why he says that their hearts are full. Al-Kain Molelev B'nilatim. Therefore, the hearts of man are full to do evil. What do you mean full? They found justification to go full throttle after their lusts. Because that's what they were looking for. They weren't searching for truth. They just had a previous agenda to satisfy themselves, and they just looked for one case to justify themselves. So it shows you, that's how a foolish person works. I was talking to somebody I told you a month ago or so, that there's a guy who's a skeptic, and he went through the yeshiva system, and he had good teachers, and he's no longer religious. And what's his whole argument? Oh, we've got Jews in the desert for 40 years. How can we have no remnants? So he takes one thing, which is not a proof itself, because the absence of something is not a positive. You can't say that since I don't have any evidence, that is now a positive. You can't make a rule from it. You can't make a statement from it. Yeah, you have no evidence. Maybe you're not looking in the right spot. And what type of evidence are you looking for? There wasn't packaged food. You could find garbage. There was no human waste. They were living off the mun that was miraculously, they had no human waste for 40 years. They had portable structures. You're not going to find any cement bricks. And the clothing grew with them, so they didn't throw out. So what type of evidence are you looking for anyway? But the way he was working is that he had one thing which he could, you know, sort of hang his hat on, and he doesn't look at all the rest of the evidence. The fact that all the greatest minds in history, and not only the Jews, I'm not saying the greatest, there are greater minds than other religions, but number one, you have all the great minds in the Jewish camp that claim the history to be only one history of the Jews, of Egypt and the plagues and Sinai, Revelation, and even the other religions accept that because they couldn't ignore the fact that you had millions of people that were passing on a singular history. But this one person, this one Jew today, feels they're all wrong. It's just amazing arrogance how he can do this. But you see the way the skeptic works is he finds one thing that to his mind is an out that justifies everything. That's all he wants to do. He's just trying to justify a life where he can abandon having all the problems that come along with keeping the Torah and having to keep kosher and the Sabbath. He doesn't even look at the positive aspect. He's just looking at now he's restricted by laws. He wants to have an unrestricted life. So what does this type of person do? Exactly what King Solomon is saying here in 11. That their hearts are full to run after their evil as soon as they have one, and it's not like they have anything secure. All they have in verse 11 is that the guy sinned and nothing happened quickly. It doesn't mean that the punishment didn't come to that person. It didn't happen quickly. Meaning to say that the person will ignore when a person is punished later on. Oh, that's not, he's not getting punished for this. That just happened. He made a bad decision in life or something like that. They'll disassociate the punishment from the crime because of a span of time. So you see, it's a new point we just discovered here. He's not saying that the punishment didn't come, that it didn't come quickly. So there was enough room, there was wiggle room in there for a person who's a skeptic to say, oh, when he gets the punishment later on, which evidently he does get it, because he's King Solomon saying the punishment didn't come quickly. Oh, but the punishment does come. But there's enough wiggle room in there for a skeptic to say, it's not because of God giving it to him. Really, the sinful stuff that he did, he didn't get punished for. So this is the, it's a good eye-opener in terms of how these type of individuals work, what their motivations are, and how they're wired in terms of what their real interest is in life. It's not truth.
Rabbi?
Yeah.
I beg to differ with that man who said that it's not recorded. It's recorded in the Torah that the clothes grew with the people, that the people had them on. What was he expecting to find? A special book made? I mean, he believes it was George Washington.
He admits these things are recorded. But he says, oh, these were just made up over the years. Different authors, the style of the Torah. One spot is different than the style. All of a sudden, he's a master of literary style, too. You'll see that they're just looking to get away from restriction. When, in fact,
a person who is trying to prove his point will find every, will make every effort to find something to say, see, I'm right, see.
Oh, yeah, you should have seen the email that he sent me. It was a list of arguments, like 30 points long, all which were completely not thought out, not formulated, and they feel that if they give enough points, oh, there must be some truth here. See, there's a tactic in that if you talk enough, that there's people will think you're really saying something.
Right. So how do you handle that?
How do you handle it? You stick to one point, and you don't move from it until they answer you. And that's what I did. And I said to him, if you don't answer me on this one point, we can't have a conversation. I will answer you, but if the conversation means that when I bring up a point, you respond to it, not that you jump to another point. He didn't respond, so I said, I'm sorry. We can't have this conversation. And that was the end.
That may have been the right position to take.
Well, I found it also that since this guy is a Jew, so Maimonides says, and he quotes the Talmud, that don't engage a Jewish heretic. And it could be because since he's more knowledgeable of the sources, so then he'll you're just going to give him more rope, to hang himself with. He's just going to distort more and more. The bottom line, that's it. I mean, like Richard said once, you have the simplest verse in the Torah that says, "Hear, O Israel, God is our God, God is one." And yet the Christians take that to mean the Trinity, because it says the word God three times in that verse. Oh, that must be there's a Trinity. So even the most simplest statement, a person wants to, he can completely distort it. So, that's all questions you have.
Yeah, thank you.
It's a shame. I mean, you can see as we had the discussion, he had this venom coming out. We have no relationship whatsoever. We never said boo to each other. And he's making these accusations like, oh, that's the type of answer I would have accepted in high school and things of that nature. Just what is he making personal attacks for? Because that's all he has. So forget it. Maimonides says, I was just looking at it yesterday, in the Mishnah Torah, it's a good chapter to look through. He talks about the laws of Talmud Torah, the laws of learning Torah, teaching Torah, chapter 3. I mean, the whole thing is just a beautiful work. It's amazing. But there he talks about, and he says that, or it's either that chapter, the fourth chapter, the third or the fourth, and he says that you only teach somebody Torah who has proper character traits. Meaning to say that if a person is not have proper traits, so then you try to teach him, he's just, his emotions are going to twist whatever you give him to fit into his emotional agenda. So it's useless.
Thank you.
Okay, let me see. Avner has some questions on screen. As I see it then, it is Hashem playing with human characteristics at the end of the day, but then without closing doors quickly. I'm not sure what you mean. Let me see your next sentence. But then there's still the cost of suffering for the tzaddik, the righteous person, that may not see some physical results in his life. Okay, we'll get to that. He actually goes into that in verse 14, which is the next verse. All right, so, and actually Ibn Ezra says that from verse 14, for the next 16 verses, it's all one theme. So that'll be a very interesting study. Because he says here in 14, he says, there is a futility which there is performed on earth, that there comes to the righteous people the events of the wicked. And then there are some wicked people that what reaches them is like the events of the righteous. And I said, this also is a futility. Meaning the good people have it bad, the bad people have it good. So that's the famous question. And that's Abner, what you're asking. So we'll have to see. Okay, how are we doing over there? Jim, Carolyn, Doug, Cal? Any other questions or any comments?
Rabbi?
Yes?
In answer to that last statement that you made, people want to know why good things happen to bad people and bad things happen to good people.
Okay, we'll see if King Solomon takes that up and where he's going with that statement.
Okay.
Rabbi, in the earlier part, I think we ended up talking about the person who has no children, and we said, well, why should it matter? What difference does it make to him when he's dead? Is that our conclusion?
Yes.
So in this section, we postulated that the part about fearing God refers to the world to come, or at least in part. But isn't there a, for the person who has children, and those children do righteous things, doesn't some, if we're talking about the world to come, doesn't some benefit inure to the ancestor because of that, so that there is in fact an effect on a righteous person who doesn't have children, or maybe not an effect, but the loss of a potential benefit?
No, the reward of a person is based on his own doing. So when he's gone, so what his children do on earth, whether he has them and they're doing good, or if he doesn't have them, that is of no effect. He has now concluded his life. His perfection has achieved to that level once he dies. So there's no more effect on him. People have this notion today where they say that, you know, we do this, we'll benefit, we'll elevate the soul of our ancestor. But where's the righteousness in that? A friend of mine said very well, so if Hitler's grandchildren are righteous people, so that's now going to benefit him? It's a very stark contrast, but I think his point was right on. And that's what I think King Solomon's saying over here, that it's a foolish thing to make a complaint against the Torah system to say, look, here's a wicked person, he's had such a nice burial, and he has children that live after him, and here's a righteous person who's like so perfect, and he has no child left over, and people forget who he is. So we have to stop and say, but that does not have any effect on the perfection of either one. The person was sinful in his life, and then he dies. It doesn't matter how nice of a funeral he had or who fills his shoes. He was wicked, and that's it. There's no changing that. And conversely, if a person is righteous, it doesn't matter that there were, whatever the circumstances came up, that he had no son to take over, or if the people in his city forgot all about him. That doesn't detract one iota from his great perfection in life. And it wouldn't add to his perfection if he did leave over children. Only in as much as that having a child is a fulfillment of a command. But that he had when he was alive, The fact that he dies and the child is there, that doesn't add to it. He did the act, he got married, he had a child, so that was a mitzvah. That was a fulfillment of a mitzvah. Now when he dies and the child is left over and is fulfilling, you know, filling his shoes, that doesn't add anything to him. The mitzvah was done. So the credit to a person's soul is based on his acts in this life. And once his life is over, so there's no affecting it.
So there's a slight alteration, but on the same subject vein. Why was it so important then for Joseph to have his corpse carried out of Egypt and returned to the land of his ancestors, or Jacob rather? If you know, you're dead, and okay, then sort of the accounting takes place, and that's that.
Right. So Rashi addresses your question, and he says one answer was that he did not want that his body, because you see the what is it called, the sarcophagus that they had in Egypt.
Here.
What's that?
Right, sarcophagus. Yeah, I think that's right.
Right. So they used to have these sarcophagi, I guess it would be sarcophagi, would be the plural. And this would be like their mausoleum. They brought all their tools in Egyptian culture into their final resting spot, and all their clothing and their tools, because they had this idea about going to continuing their, you know, their life with their tools and whatever it was. And this was a wrong concept. And Jacob knew they would do that to him as well, and he did not want to be a cause to mislead the Egyptian people. So that's Rashi says one reason why he told them to take my bones out. I don't want to be a stumbling block in my death. Not that it affects him at all. He was just concerned for the welfare of the Egyptian culture. I mean, the Torah also has a command not to consult the dead, because you can't consult the dead. God can. As a matter of fact, there's one incident where when the spies were going into the land, so God did not tell Moses and the people to spy out the land when they were, you know, in the book of Numbers. So God says to Moses, if the people come to you and they want to send out spies, I already told them the land is good. Go in, just take it over. But if they still are insecure, Moses, you make the decision if you want it. You're the leader. So he sent that prince for each one of the 12 tribes. And out of the 10 princes, only two of them were good, Joshua and Caleb. So Moses knew this. But the very fact they came to him to spy out, he knew they had this insecurity. But Joshua had never left Moses' tent, so he knew him very well. But he still changed his name. At that point, his name was Hoshea, and he changed it to Joshua, meaning he'd added on a letter of God's name, meaning to say that God should watch over you, that you should be insulated from the evil counsel of the spies, and you shouldn't succumb to their counsel, because when you're one and you're going up against City Hall, it can have a big effect on your emotions. And Moses knew that. So he prayed for Joshua. Interesting, he didn't have to pray for Caleb. He saw something different in Caleb, and he knew that he'd be able to control himself. But what did Caleb do? When they all went and they left to spy out the land, so Caleb separated out from the group, and he went to Hebron, and Hebron was where the patriarchs' tombs were. Abraham and Sarah, Isaac and Rebekah, and Jacob and Leah. Well, why did he go there? So the Talmud says that he went to the graves and he spread himself out. Now, the Talmud explains that he was not talking to them. One view that Tosfos cites over there is that he was praying to God that he should have strength to stand up against the Morocco. And I think Tosfos says that he prayed to God and that God would communicate with the patriarchs and the matriarchs, because of course they're still very much alive. The soul is alive, and that God's the only one that's in contact with them. So what the communication was, whatever, it doesn't really say. But the point that he went there is that they were the ones that God initially established the promise to give the land of Israel. So that's exactly why Caleb went to this point. He was now going to look at the burial spot of these people, the ones that God made the oath to give the land of Israel, and that would solidify and firm his position and fortify him from succumbing to the council of the spies. And eventually tried to come back and incite a riot, and they did. But he didn't pray to them. So speaking to the dead is not even something that he did, even in the one case we have where he went, you ever a case over there. And that's actually one rabbi. It's not like a history. The verse says that Caleb went to Hebron. The verse does not say what he was doing in Hebron. One of the rabbis elaborates, and he says, so it's not a historical fact. He's trying to give an insight of what was going on over there. But just like, you know, it works that way, he's not communicating with the dead, so the dead also, once the person is dead, he's not affected by what people are doing on earth. His perfection is sealed. So every case has to really be, you know, looked into, like, you know, you just raised about Jacob wanting his bones to be taken out. Each case, we have to look into it and see exactly what was going on. There's reason behind it. It will, you know, continually support, you know, the fundamentals, the Torah fundamentals. And why did God hide Moses burying his burial spot? Because he knew that people would deify him and go to him. You see that happening today. People go to the graves of righteous people, and they make them into, like, these, you know, mystical, Kabbalistic, you know, channels to, you know, you need a mate, go to this grave, this great person, and you'll get married in 40 days. The things, you know, just real idolatrous type of practice. So, you see, God's act was to hide Moses' burial spot. And I think even the people who did still try to look for it, it calls them wicked. So people might look at it as like being very innocuous. No, there's a wickedness there. Separate thing. What is that wickedness? And after you're saying is that it's funny that we never have a mystical explanation. And you're saying that's different from what you're used to having where you are. Yeah, I understand. Mysticism is something, I know you're in Avner, just so everybody knows, Avner's from Brazil. And I think there's a lot of the Chabad. And there is a lot of mysticism, a lot of just baseless, you know, things. They feel good statements that are really against Torah. And it's unfortunate. And we have to just go back to the source. I mean, we have the Torah, we have the sources, we have the rabbis, and you look through the Torah, you have no such use of amulets. You have, even when the mandrakes, when Rachel wanted the mandrakes of Reuben, that was for a fertility issue. There's no such thing as mysticism. When Rachel was barren and she said to Jacob, give me children. So Jacob was very angry. He says, am I in God's place? I can't do anything. So here you have a prophet is claiming that he has no ability to make any changes in the physical world. He tells Rachel, God has held you from having children. He's held you back, so you have to pray, whatever it is. But it's between you and God. There's nothing I can do. And people today do just the opposite. They'll take money and they'll say, give me money and I'll pray for you for 40 days at the Western Wall, and this will be a guarantee that now you'll find a mate, or now you'll become pregnant. Complete lies. You see what Torah has become. And it's all because people are not studying, and they're not going back to the source, and they're denying what you see how the prophets lived. They're denying God's word. Okay. Any questions or comments? I see we're running like 12:15 now.
We're good here.
Okay. All right. So I guess we'll wrap it up over here. Pick up next week. Now we'll move on to a new issue, which is 8:14 about how he starts talking about how the righteous seem to meet with ill fate and the wicked seem to be meeting with a good fate. Let's see where he goes with that. Okay, so look it over. Look over the next couple of verses. And he says the next, this is Ibn Ezra, he says the next 16 verses are on this one theme. Okay? The Inyan Shalmela. And it says that then it's, and it's joined with the previous matter that we were just discussing too. Okay, so everybody have a good week. Okay, Mike, you too have a good week. Avner and Ryan. And we'll continue. Let me see, Avner, you have one more point. My point is this sort of leveling Jews down. Not many Jews have large Torah knowledge, but there are those who know more and those who know less. So mysticism ends up working as a way to putting all on the same level. Yeah, but it's wrong. It's wrong out there. They're trying to just, you know, pull the wool over their eyes. And the objective is to get the truth, not to have everybody agreeing on some point which may be very false or idolatrous. Right? It's not to make people feel good. That's not the Torah system. It's to understand. But if a person sees the truth, he will feel good. He'll see it with his mind. It'll resonate. Okay. Good week, everybody. We'll pick up next week, same time, all right?
Thanks, Rabbi. You have a great week, too.
Okay. Thank you. Have a good week, everybody. Thank you.